Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
We are celebrating one of the most pivotal men in American football history, Walter Camp. And we have an author that wrote the book, Walter Camp, The Creation of American Football, Roger Tamptee. And his interview is coming up next. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with their tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. And in this bonus edition of the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, we are bringing recognition to perhaps the most important man in American football history, Walter Camp, who many in the last 100 years or so have called the father of American football. There is some controversy and some inconsistency somewhat as to what day Camp was born on. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But as stated earlier on the Pigskin Dispatch, we're declaring this as Walter Camp weekend, just the same on the Pigskin Dispatch. Helping us in this study of Walter Camp is an expert and an author of an excellent book on the man titled Walter Camp, The Creation of American Football, authored by Roger R. Tamptee, a scholar of early American football who studied Camp for many years. Roger Tamptee, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We are certainly glad to have you, Roger. And we'd like to just learn a little bit about you. What brought your interest into the game of football?
Well, I've always been interested in football. Actually, I grew up in Iowa, but my parents were from Minnesota. I was born in Minnesota, so I always had a little loyalty to Minnesota. I worked for 3M. In St. Paul, Minnesota, was a patent attorney for them for 30 some years plus some consulting years. When I finished working for them, I wanted to work on some project, and I've always been interested in history, and I was interested in the University of Minnesota football, which in the 1930s had some national champions. Bernie Bierman was a coach, and there didn't seem to be a lot written about them. So I thought, well, I think I'd like to try and research that. And I got started on it. But pretty soon I began to realize there was not any well-documented or book about the creation of American football. And so I started to investigate that and became more and more interested and serious about it. I didn't immediately study Camp, but pretty soon I realized that he was the key figure. And so I began to focus more on him.
Yeah, he's a very interesting figure. I had sort of a similar path. I used to be a football official, and I would do some writing on the side for football officiating for some websites. And I got assigned to write on the football rules history. And I became, of course, football rules history, it sort of starts with Walter Camp, and which we'll talk about here in a few minutes, some of his accomplishments. But yeah, the man is truly interesting and his contributions to the game of football. You said, you grew up in Minnesota and Iowa, right in the Midwest, but, and you learned a lot about Camp through looking at some of the early history. Now, what was some of your research that you did to look up Camp on the game of football?
I don't remember the exact sequence of what happened, but I started off researching in Minnesota Historical Society Library. Soon realized that if I was really going to study the creation of football, I needed to get closer to Yale and Harvard and Princeton, which were the so-called big three of that early football. So I was I was really in retirement, and I began to travel. Now, I guess I don't remember the exact sequence, but I was working part-time for 3M even then as a consultant, and I occasionally had to go to D.C., where the patent office was, to have a meeting at the patent office. And I would extend those trips on my dollar and I'd go over to the Library of Congress. And I began to get some feel for information. I found a couple of early camp writings in their rare books collection. I believe it was something like 2003, I took a trip out to, I actually went to each of Princeton, Harvard, and Yale. And I suppose on that trip, I realized that Yale had the papers for Walter Camp. And they had about over 50 microfilm reels of papers that had been assembled very, very carefully and thoroughly. And I began to look at them, came home with what I had gathered, but soon decided I needed to go again. And I should say, you know, I really have no training in historical research. And maybe was not as careful as I should have been, because I would learn things and I could remember that I'd read them, but I didn't take good enough notes to always find them. So sometimes when I went back, I had to look things up again or look things over.
I've had the same issue happen to me, so don't worry about that.
Okay. I went to Harvard and Princeton maybe 3-4 times, but I ended up going to Yale more than that. I suppose I spent more time at the University of Minnesota libraries. They had very good newspaper and magazine collections covering the time period when American football was being developed. So I would go there probably at least once a week and try and dig through the newspaper files, magazine files. I basically enjoyed the research. It's drudgery in many times. And yet when you find something that's new and you're pretty sure it's interesting, why, that's exciting. And it's kind of like exploring. You're an explorer out there trying to track down things. And so I've turned out I enjoyed very much the process of researching. These were kind of my retirement years. So my wife and I took a few trips going south in the wintertime, and we'd go places like Auburn. I found some material for my book in Auburn. A young professor at Auburn really instigated getting the students interested and able to play football. And John Heisman came along as their coach. That was his first really major 5-year. He was there for 5 years. That turned out to have some relevance to the book, even though it didn't have a lot to do with camp. But I lost track of your question now.
That's all right. You answered it very well on your research. Now, you know, just digging into that a little bit, I want the listeners to appreciate, because, you know, I've also read a lot of, you know, Camp's put out a lot of things in periodicals, and he's written books, and I have a few copies of my own collection. But even people at the time, some of the terminology and things that what we call today were called differently back then. So you almost have to, it's almost somewhat interpreting a different language, you know, going back 130 years ago, talking about the game of football. You know, as a matter of fact, the word football was broken into two words, the word foot and word ball early on. So it's, I can appreciate your research and being studious, because sometimes it is drudgery to read some of that and try to incorporate it into today's language.
You sort of come up with your own terminology too. For example, we're going to talk about downs. And I've come up with the term downs and distance. It's really what the rule's about. But that's just my own idea. There are other ways to describe it too. But I
guess one of the best examples of it, you know, is the word snapper back is what that was used quite a bit. And that, you know, we can translate that to snapper or to what we call today the center who snaps a ball. But the snapper back was one that sort of threw me for a loop a little bit. You know, just things like that. It's a difficult thing to research that time sometimes in the writings. So I appreciate your diligence on what you did because I know what a chore it is. Now, if we could change gears a little bit, in your studies, you know, we know we're going to talk a lot about Camp, the innovator and coach and game of football. But can you tell us a little bit about what kind of a person was Walter Camp?
He was he grew up in New Haven. His father was an elementary school principal, and he attended the school where his father was the principal, and then went on to a private school in New Haven. He was always very interested in sports, I believe. Had a chance to see certain, if baseball came to New Haven, he had a chance to go see it, do things like that. He talks about wrestling, and when he got to Yale, well, he had played baseball at the private school, Hopkins Grammar School, and played baseball for them and played soccer. But at Yale, for example, he, besides football, he played varsity baseball. He was in the first intercollegiate tennis tournament as on the doubles team representing Yale. He competed in intramural events in track and field. So he had a very, very deep involvement in sports, but he was also a good student. I would say not at the very top tier, but he won, he was recognized for his scholarship, and he was interested in writing. He'd been interested in writing ever since he was at Hopkins. He was on their newspaper staff. He also wrote poetry, had some poetry published. And I would say he was also a very diligent person. I mean, he would undertake tasks and he'd follow through on them. And he was, during the development of football, as we might see as we talk further, he was very responsible and really carried the effort, I think, in many ways. He was the only person who continued during those early years. I mean, most of them would come along for 3 years, maybe, and once they finished school, then they left. But he continued to be involved and very diligent and responsible. He was always characterized as quiet. Exactly what that meant, I don't know. I mean, he certainly he ended up being a coach and doing things like that. So he could speak when he needed to speak, but he was kind of in the background and quiet.
It's always the quiet ones you have to watch out for, right?
Well, something's going on, maybe. Yeah.
And I believe if I read correctly, he was got after school, he was still coaching at Yale, but he became involved in a family business in New Haven.
Well, when he finished school, he graduated from undergraduate school 4 years and then attended medical school for 3 years. He did not graduate from medical school, however, but when he finished the spring of 83, he said he wanted to catch on in business. He got a job for a clock company or a watch company in New York City. Connecticut was very prominent in the clock and watch industry. But he didn't stay with them very long because some of the graduates who were very much believers in him and what he could do for Yale and student athletic associations offered him a job at Yale to be in charge of all the athletic interests at the school. Now, in those days, it was the students and the graduates who were interested. There's not a lot of interest by the officials at school. So he worked that year in that position, and really, you can tell, hoped that Yale would hire him to continue that job as a regular Yale official. But they didn't. The Yale president, I don't think, thought it was the right thing for. And so when he in 84, after he'd worked at Yale for a year in sports, he began work for the New Haven Clock Company. They had an official named Camp, but he was not related to Walter. And it was a stock investment company, but Camp continued there. He went to work in New York for about 3 years in the sales capacity. Came back to New Haven and was sort of, you'd probably call him the sales manager. And then in the early 1900s, he was named chief executive president of the company. And he was the president of the New Haven Clock Company, which was a worldwide company for about 20 years.
You talk about him having to travel quite a bit, you know, go to New York City. And I think by train, New York City is probably an hour away from New Haven. So quite a bit of traveling. So coaching a football team can be quite difficult. But he had some help, I believe, from his wife. If you could go into that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it was common among former players to go back and help their teams after they graduated. And he did some of that. But in 1888, the captain of the Yale football team, who obviously was an admirer, had confidence in what Camp could do, asked him to really take full charge of their team. And it so happened that Camp had just married Alice. That was the name of his wife. And
Graham Sumter, was it, I believe?
I know her name very well, but I can't come up with it right now. But anyway, Walter was, they got married in July of 88, I believe. And Walter started that fall as coaching the team. I don't think he had a lot of money. He lived in a house where, right in back of where his parents lived, he and Alice. Of course, he was working for the clock company, so he couldn't always be at practice. But she went in his place, and that's kind of hard to believe, but it's quite well documented. So she went out there, walked the sidelines, and then took notes, I guess, and in the evening would talk to Walter about what she had seen. And the players got to like her. They called her Mrs. Walter, and she must have done a pretty good job. Then in the evening, the captain would come over, and often some players would come over to their house and they'd talk about practice steps they needed to take. I don't know how much that happened. I assume he was at practice a fair amount, but I'm sure there were a lot of times when he couldn't attend practice. So she went in his stead.
Yeah. Can you imagine what most wives today would do if the husband said, "Hey, can you go down to the football practice and take some notes? Well, I'm going to go to work." I know my wife would probably throw a couple shoes at me or something if I asked a question like that. So she must have been very understanding.
Yeah, right.
Very supportive. Okay. So he had a lot of help. He had a really deep roots into his into the town of New Haven and Yale. Now, let's get into maybe some of his contributions and innovations. What are some of the big innovations that Camp brought to football?
Well, I think the first big one was the American scrimmage rule. And there's Camp never said that he was the inventor of that rule, although I think most writers presume he was. But what happened there, I guess, was, American football was derived from rugby. Harvard was introduced to rugby by McGill College in Montreal in the early 1870s. Harvard challenged Yale, so Yale played them, and they played them in 1975, which was kind of, I guess, not really a very clear cut as to the rules they were using. But in 1876, they played again, and there they used the regular rugby rules, pretty much. And after other schools got interested also. So at the end, in the fall of 1876, Columbia, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale formed the Intercollegiate Association, Football Association, and they adopted the regular rugby rules as their as the rules they would play by. Rugby scrimmage rule, which I'd like to read.
Sure.
It says a scrimmage takes place when the holder of the ball, being on the field of play, puts it down on the ground in front of him, and all who have closed around on their respective sides endeavor to push their opponents back, and by kicking the ball, drive it in the direction of the opposite goal line. I think of this as kind of a brute force type of game. They're intended to clash in the scrum and physically fight their way through that scrum and kick, each kicking opposite directions. But it was kind of a rough situation. They adopted that rule. The Americans adopted that rule, but they really didn't like it very much. Rugby had been in place in England for many years. I've got a novel that was based on at rugby school, Tom Brown Schoolboys, it's called. And they have a rugby game described in there. And they describe the scene of a scrimmage. Here come two of the Bulldogs. In they go, straight to the heart of the scrimmage, bent on driving the ball out the other side. Americans, when they started playing that game, sometimes the varsity scrimmaged against the scrubs, and the varsity was bigger, and they could drive it through the scrubs. And so the scrubs began to think of something else, and they began to kick the ball sideways. And eventually they began to kick it backwards. They also didn't like the rugby method because when the two teams were clashing in the scrum and bouncing the ball back and forth, it often bounced out in unpredictable directions. And Camp said that conflicted with the Americans' idea of order and preparation. The Americans didn't have this history in rugby and weren't committed to it. So they began to try other things. And one of the things they tried was to kick the ball backwards and hope one of their backs would get it and run around the scrum. And that became effective. At some point, what Camp wrote was an adventuresome spirit, developed a very vigorous backwards kick. He was able to place his foot on the ball and kick it backwards. And I'm assuming this was in the tangle of a rugby scrum. He somehow got his foot on the ball and was able to kick it out quickly so that the collegians began to call it a snapback. I guess it was fast enough and quick enough that they used the word snapback on it. However, the ball was kicked, and it was rolling and bouncing on the ground. So one of the backs gradually would move closer and closer behind the guy who was kicking to be able to grab the ball before the opponents came through the line and grabbed it instead. And they began to call him the quarterback. I think they chose that kind of just based on the location that he was closer to the line than the halfback who was but anyway, the American style scrimmage, or what I call the snapback scrimmage, developed out of that situation. 1879 and 1880, really the Americans deleted the rugby scrimmage lines of coming together and attempting to force their way through, and instead substituted other words, which again, I'd like to read this. This rule was introduced in the 1880 scrimmage, in an 1880 rule book. A scrimmage takes place when the holder of the ball, being in the field of play, puts it on the ground in front of him. All those words are exactly the same words from the rugby language. But then this is the new part. And puts it in play when onside by kicking or snapping it back. The man who first receives the ball from a snapback shall be called a quarterback. Those seem simple words, but they accomplished a revolution. Rugby's brute force, forward kicking, scrimmage battles were replaced with ordered play, planned and thought out in advance. That happened because they knew who was going to kick the ball back. So that team was on offense. Whereas in rugby, both teams were in the same status. I mean, you're on offense if you had the ball, but if the other team got the ball, then you were on defense. But in this case, they started the scrimmage with one team in charge of the ball. And so that team could know that it was going to be able to handle the ball and could put in effect a plan that they had practiced. And it obviously changed the whole nature of the game. It's not clear who wrote those words, although Camp is commonly thought of as having written those words. What we know for sure is that he wrote a manual of instruction to go along with the rules. That manual, 11 pages of pretty detailed description, was part of the 1880 rule book. And obviously he had given this a lot of thought, and probably Yale had practiced it. That became the American scrimmage rule.
I mean, just stop for a second and think about, I mean, how important that development is. You know, basically, the invention of the quarterback, or creation of the quarterback, and creation of play calling, you know, the plans that you're talking about, play calling for offenses, and so subsequently defenses could call plays. So that's just the whole, probably the main source of interest for the game of football, is just that give and take, and those, you know, one team scheming against the other with their plays trying to gain an advantage. And I mean, that's gigantic in the game.
Yeah, it is. And it still has its effect today. Camp later, quite a few years later, the game was growing more and more popular, and he listed some reasons why he thought the game was popular. And the first one he listed was the fact that the game is constantly developing. It's always open to new methods. And that all arises from this fact that it's a game of planning. And the plans, there's quite a open slate of possibilities, and they keep developing and developing and developing. And it's responsible for what American football has become. So yes, it is. It was a very crucial and important rule. Now, however, I think you also asked about the downs rule, and I think that one is a very important rule also. This was definitely a Camp invention. The first purpose was to correct a flaw in the 1880 scrimmage rule. Nothing in that rule limited a team in the number of possessions they could have. And so teams, an inferior team would stall, would not really try to move the ball forward. They would try simply to hold on to the ball so that the other team could not score. And that way they at least would not lose. But those games were called block games. And the Americans tried a while to overcome that problem, but they didn't really solve it. And so in April 1882, they had an emergency rulemaking meeting. All four schools sent three delegates. It was the largest rulemaking meeting they'd had at that point. Camp was in medical school, but he was a delegate for Yale. And he came in with a proposed rule reading, if in three consecutive downs a team does not advance the ball at least 5 yards, they must give up the ball to the opposite side on the spot of the last down. Very familiar ideas. Mm-hmm. It was 3 downs, 5 yards. But today, you know, we think of that as kind of a natural or logical thing. But when Camp proposed it in 82, it really wasn't. I mean, if you think of the fact that putting a limit on the number of downs, which they didn't have, but also providing a way to extend that limit, that was a new idea and a new creation. Conditioning the extension on how many yards the offensive team achieved within a certain down number of downs was also a new idea. And using physical measurements to measure the distance a team had moved in 3 downs was a very new idea. And the other delegates were all opposed to this idea. They said, you'll need a surveyor on the field to make it work, or constant delays will surely occur. The referee will be given superior powers and face impossible decisions. And this is kind of an interesting sidelight, but Camp answered them by suggesting that the field be marked with lines 5 yards apart. And the other delegates laughed and said, it'll look like a gridiron. And as far as I know, that's the first time that word was used that, you know, has become so common in describing a football field. Finally, the chair of the meeting, who was also opposed to the idea, but he had worked with Camp enough to have some confidence in him, obtained a compromise. He says, and he persuaded them to enact the rule on the condition that in the fall, if it didn't work, they would cancel the rule. Well, when the fall came, the play was so clearly improved that no effort was made to kill the rule. There was, first of all, an absence of block games. But more importantly, the game had been made more interesting and compelling. Each down was important. Players had an exciting new focus. Each down became important to obtain the required yardage. Viewers knew what was at stake and were more interested, sat on the edge of their chairs wondering, will they make these yards? Each down really told a story with winners, losers, and sometimes heroics. So Camp always said that is the most important rule in our game. And I think he was being sincere. It turned out that in 1912, the first historian of the rule, Park Davis, wrote that Camp's 1882 downs and distance rule has made American football preeminent over all other games of strategy and prearranged tactics. So other people were thinking it was an important rule also.
Yeah, definitely a big contribution. I can't imagine going to a game and watching one team have the ball the entire game and just staying in the same place. That would be kind of boring. I think the game probably would have died out if it stayed that way.
They were worried about that. That's why they had an emergency meeting of 12 people, because they really were worried that it could die out.
Yeah, Camp, that's a brilliant idea he had. And, you know, and there was no other thing like it. You know, nobody had ever seen, like you said. So that's really interesting.
That's right.
Now, if we could, if we could fast forward to maybe the 1904, 1905, what the temperature of football was and what was about to happen and how Camp sort of it was involved in that. The whole thing with the, there was no passing game at that point in time.
It was always a dangerous game, of course, but it became, there came a time when there were a number of injuries and a number of deaths. The public became upset about it and pushed for some sort of change. Camp, John Heisman had written some letters and claimed that he had suggested the idea of forward passing to Camp. I never found any letters from Heisman in the Camp papers, so I don't know just what happened. But Camp was not too interested. He really, they began to have in 1906, I haven't really looked this up recently, but I think 1906 was the first year that the committee, rules committee, met. And a number of the members of the committee advocated forward passing, a very limited kind of forward passing, but Camp opposed. However, they did start in 1905. In 1906, they did pass the rule committee over Camp's and others' objections. Did put in rules allowing passing. I think they also in that year increased the downs, the yards that had to be made in three downs. It was still three downs, but they increased it to 10 yards. Now, President Theodore Roosevelt gets mixed into this story also. He was a friend of Camp's and a great admirer of Camp's. You know, I have not gone back and really refreshed myself on the story, and I don't think I want to take it on, but it's a really interesting story. Roosevelt eventually became persuaded that Camp was wrong and that there needed to be a change. And he did some things to help that process along so that eventually in 1912, a quite liberal passing rule was passed. Again, Camp opposed. They did at that point increase the number of downs to four. So in 1912, I think it was four downs to make 10 yards. But at the end of the 1912 season, Camp wrote he had started a guide that contained the rules. And it had become taken over by Spalding. Camp was the editor and a main writer for this guide. And he wrote in that guide that 1912 has proved the effectiveness of rulemaking. And and was very complimentary of forward passing. I think that's another insight into camp, that although he had opposed vigorously, and the end he had lost, but he realized, I think he had been wrong, and that forward passing was going to be a very important part of the game. And it was, of course, and he used it. He used forward passing in his own coaching at Yale.
I believe it was even to the extent, you know, going back to the 1906, after, you know, Roosevelt sort of put the hammer down and told the Intercollegiate Rules Committee they had to make some changes to make the game safer, institution of the forward pass. But Camp and some of the proponents that did not, or opponents of the forward pass, put in some strict rules that first year. Like if you threw a forward pass and it was incomplete, it was turned over on downs, like a recovered fumble. So you couldn't pass any more than 5 yards downfield. Some really crazy rules that we wouldn't even recognize today. I'm glad to hear, you know, 1912, that, you know, Camp saw the value of the forward pass and, you know, basically said, hey, you know what? You guys are right. This is great for the game. And, you know, just like you said in that 1912 rule book, Spalding handled. So, yeah, that's some great stuff there. Let's fast forward another decade here. You know, Camp continued to go to the rules committee meetings that they were held annually, sometimes a couple times every year. You know, he was extremely dedicated to the rules. And if you could take us maybe up to that 1925 rules convention, his last committee that he attended.
World War One came along during this time also. After the 1912 meeting and agreement, there were some rule changes, but within 2 or 3 years, they had reached a point that they made almost no changes to the rule book. That was really quite a change. I mean, almost every year until that time, there had been some fairly significant rule changes. But Camp said the game is working well at this point, and we should let it continue. And so it did. After the war, during the war, there were a number of Army and Navy football teams. So people got exposed to football that way. They also got some pent-up demand because some of the schools stopped playing football. So at the end of the war, by 1920-21, the game had really increased in number a lot. And really during the 1920s, a lot of the major football stadiums were built. But anyway, leading up to 1925, I don't think there was anything really earth-shaking that was going to be held at that rulemaking meeting. But Camp had pretty much attended all of the meetings, and he went. He was 65 years old, I think, at that time. And they met together on Friday night and had some discussions, but planned to have further meetings the next day. They all went home to their hotel room, and Saturday morning, the committee met, but the usually prompt Camp was not there. And after an hour or two, the chairman of the committee sent a couple people to go look for Camp. And they got the hotel manager to open up the door, and they found that Camp had died during the night, apparently at peace in his bed. And it's very ironic. Here, this man who gave his life to football really died during the night between two sessions of the rulemaking committee. Obviously quite a shock for his wife. That was the end of Walter Camp's participation in the rulemaking.
You know, I always maybe I'm over romanticizing the situation, but you know, I always like to think of it, you know, he accomplished so much and went through so much controversy to keep this game of football. You know, first of all, to get it off, help get it off the ground and playing it and, you know, adapting rules and adopting rules and, you know, going to all these meetings and practices and going through the whole Teddy Roosevelt, you know, summons to the White House and the forward pass, you know, controversies. And he overcame all that. And football in the 1920s has sort of settled down, like you said, and there wasn't a whole lot of innovations taking place at that time, at least in the major rule innovations. But he was sort of, you know, goes to that Friday night meeting. And you said how he died peacefully. I always like to envision it as he was sort of at peace with the game of football. And, you know, to be a football icon, to go out at a football rules meeting, there's just something about that that's astonishing and ironic, like you said, but also, you know, almost in a romantic sense that brings nostalgia to the event. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, you know, he died doing the thing he loved, I guess, is a best way to say it.
Yeah. There's a, you know, Grantland Rice, Walter Camp had presented an All-American team in Collier's magazine for many years. And when Camp died, Rice took that job over. But Rice was kind of a poet, was a poet. As he wrote a poem that I always thought was, if I can read it.
Oh, please do.
A few months after Camp died, Grantland Rice wrote this poem when he was naming the next All-America team. But Rice assumed Camp still remembered those players that he had named in the past and that he occasionally thought about them, imagined them as they marched along the skyline of memory. As they marched by, how often must have come to him the memory of the great battles which brought them fame, battles in rain and snow, in sun and shadow, the flying tackle and the savage line thrust, the forward wall braced for the shock, the graceful spiral careening against a sky of blue and gray, the long run down the field, the goal line stand, the forward pass, the singing and cheering of great crowds, young and old America gathered together on a golden afternoon with bands playing and banners flying. It may have been in the midst of such a dream that the call to quarters came and taps was sounded as the great night came down the field. Wow. I like that, so I put that in my book. It's repeated more than once, I know. But.
It's a beautiful tribute by Grantland Rice to the great man, Walter Camp. All right. I guess this is a question. Now, we've sort of encompassed the whole football life of Walter Camp. But you, being an author and being so engrossed in his life, if you could travel back in time, if I said, Roger, here's a time machine, and you can go back anytime at any point in Camp's life and either witness an event or ask a question of Camp, what might that be?
Well, you know, one idea that comes to my mind, I've always wondered what went on in these rulemaking meetings. I mean, Camp was apparently persuasive, but not a dictatorial person or a persuasive person. I'd like to sit in on one of those early rulemaking meetings and see what the manner of discussion was. And, you know, there would be a lot of times that might be of interest, but that's one that comes to my mind.
Yeah. I mean, just you saying that, it sort of put the picture in my mind. I'm picturing a room, you know, full of cigar smoke in the air. We're probably waving our hands, trying to clear the air a little bit. And maybe what you said earlier with describing Camp as sort of a quiet person, maybe he was almost like that old E.F. Hutton commercial. You know, he didn't say much, but when Walter Camp spoke, everybody listened. You know, maybe that's the instance that we could maybe look upon of what happened, you know, but that would be a good question. Now, I appreciate you coming on today with us, Roger. Now, why don't you tell us the title of your book and maybe where some of our listeners can purchase your book?
The title is Walter Camp and the Creation of American Football. And, you know, I know that Amazon has the book available, but I don't actually know other places. I'm pretty sure that if you went to a local bookstore and asked for the book, they would get it. But that's all I know.
Okay. So Amazon, I mean, that's a very common thing, place where everybody's buying books these days, the way the internet has taken over the marketplace. But again, that book is Walter Camp and the Creation of American Football by Roger R. Tamptee. Make sure you check it out at Amazon. Get a copy of it. It's a great piece of writing on a great man in American football history. And it's a very interesting read and one that everybody should have in their library. And Roger, we very much appreciate you joining us on what we're calling Walter Camp Weekend. I know we're a little bit controversial on the date, but still we're celebrating the man's life sort of in the appropriate time of year, the appropriate month, let's say, to make sure he is paid tribute to for his great contributions.
Well, thank you for asking. I've enjoyed participating, and I feel that Camp is someone who we need to know better, and it is very much the father of American football, and there should be some times when we recognize what that contribution is, because the game is obviously very important in the United States.
Well, sir, you've certainly shed some light with us here today and in your book, and we are all much wiser and more informed for it. And we thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank you for listening to this celebration of Walter Camp with Roger Tamptee's interview. And we'd like to thank Roger for joining us and participating in this, in his great book, and sharing his knowledge with us, and the University of Illinois Publishing Company that connected us with Roger and shared that great book with us. And to everybody, till tomorrow, have a great Gridiron Day.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck, because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.